Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is the Starship Sofa. Everyone, welcome. Hello and welcome to Oral Delights, show 140. I am your host, Tony C. Smith. Hello everyone. What a show. I'd always start off by saying that, but this time today, this probably out of doing Starship Sofa, this show what I'm about to put out there now, or this interview that I'm about to put out now in the Starship Sofa interrogations, and I'm so proud of Starship Sofa and just being able, proud of myself, just being able to bring this interview to you all, because it is truly, honestly, one of the best times I've had in my life in science fiction terms. Do you know, to speak to this legend who is Jack Vance and just to listen to him, you've got to listen to the whole interview because it was just one of the most awe-inspiring times I've had. Just listen to this legend who, 93 years old, and he talked for over an hour. And I'm so happy, honestly, to bring this interview to everyone. But not only that, we've got a remarkable story by one of the top leading writers, science fiction writers today, Kim Stanley Robinson as well. So this show is one mean mother of a show. There's only the two sections in it today, but you know, the interview with Jack Vance is over an hour long and the stories are big in as well. So more than enough science fiction goodness. I hope you do enjoy it. Please let everyone know about this show. You know, this Jack Vance interview needs to be, everyone needs to listen to this and just be humbled by this great man. Just a sweet, gentle guy who just, you know, I just phoned him up, you know, I got a contact name, and it was actually through, you know, I don't like to drop names, but it was through Robert Silverberg. I got in touch with Jack Vance's son, and Jack Vance's son says, yes, just phone up, Dad. It'd be lovely to talk to you. And, oh, he just, you know, It's a strange feeling, trust us, when you just dial up some of these people, you know, and ask these questions. Jack Vance just sat there and, you know, if you listen, like, you'll understand what I mean when you listen to the interview and you listen to it like halfway through when actually the 15 questions, I run out of the 15 questions and I just keep on talking. It's just a humbling experience to speak to this man. You know, I came off that telephone just inspired to be a better person. Please, if you can do one thing for us and tell everyone about this show. Do you know what I mean? We run on a budget of zero. Do you know what I mean? I've got like the monthly donations, but it's all just down to everyone's hard work. And I'm like so proud of it. Do you know what I mean? And it'd be just nice to get that word out, you know. And this is the kind of quality, honestly. You know, you listen to this story and the narration, do you know? It is by Peter Seaton Clarke, who is just a world-class narrator. You know, I'm so proud to be able to kind of bring this show, you know, with the kind of next to nothing in budget terms, you know, and deliver, I think, the best science fiction podcast out there. Do you know what I mean? Listen to it and let us know what you think. This interview with Jack Vance, he's up for a Hugo Award for best related work with his autobiography. This is me, Jack Vance. And he does gets a little plug in now and again as well. So, and I'm reading that book. I bought it straight away. I think the same night I finished talking to him, I went out over on the Amazon and bought it. It's just a fantastic book. I mean, this guy has done everything. So Starship Sova is very proud to see it. Jack Vance, are you a science fiction writer?
Am I a science fiction writer? No longer. My last science fiction story was called Luralu, which is 5 years old, but I just finished writing my autobiography.
Tell me about your childhood.
I was born in San Francisco. And Johnny's just now started up the vacuum cleaner. I don't know if you can hear it or not. But anyway, my family was quite prosperous. I don't know how to say this, but my family was, I hate to use the word wealthy, but they were up in upper ranges. And when the Depression, 1929, hit them pretty hard, and things got a little tough. And when I was five, we moved up into the country, and we're supposed to stay there just for the summer. Myself and my brothers and sisters, but they rented our house in San Francisco, and I stayed up there until I graduated from high school. Then after that, those are the days the Depression was on there, and after getting out of high school, I went to work picking fruit, and ultimately I got a job with a construction company that as a laborer, but in the Sierra Nevada mountains, building this mining construction. Then I went to University of California. I stayed there for the Cal till my junior year, and I got bored with it. Or let me think what happened. I think I went to sea. The war was on. I became a merchant seaman until after the war. I went. I started as an ordinary seaman, then became an able seaman. And cruised all over the South Pacific, backward, forward. Never hit Atlantic too much, except a coastwise run. And then, eventually, I came ashore and spent the rest of my time in Oakland and Berkeley. And that's where I am now. I'm in the house that I built myself. When we moved in here, we got the place cheap. And me and Johnny, my son, we just built ourselves a rather beautiful house here. It's up in the Oakland Hills. it's quite pleased with it. And that's where I'm calling from now. Sitting here, the phone in one hand, Johnny's upstairs. I have two grandchildren. They're in school now.
How did you get started in the science fiction genre?
When I was a kid, I subscribed to the Weird Tales magazine. And they had some very, very good writers in there, namely C.L. Moore, who is one of the really great writers, if not one of the greatest. She's a lady, and she certainly was an influence on my writing. Hugo Gernsback was publishing this Amazing Stories Quarterly, and in fact, Hugo Gernsback is the name of these Hugo, this is where the Hugo Awards are derived from. As a matter of fact, they're going to give out Hugos. They do it every year. And this year, they're having this convention or whatever it is in Australia, in Sydney. And I've been nominated. I don't know that I'll get the Hugo Award or not, but I've been nominated. So I might. I've got two other Hugo Awards. And now I might get another one. And so I'll have to, don't have to go to Australia, but I'd sure like to. I like Australia very much. It's a lovely country, really, Australia. And very nice people there. Is Australia still a dominion or are they totally independent from England? I think they recognize the Queen. Queen is the nominal head of state there. Of course, Canada and Australia, they're independent, but there's just some connection with England. I think that's the way it is, but I'm not sure. But I love England. I'd very gladly, if things get too bad here with this horrible, horrible political situation we got ourselves in there, I don't have a notion. I'd like to migrate to England. I'd like to live in south of England, Devon or Hampshire or someplace like that, or even in Cornwall. We drove one time, we got off the a ship in our car, went down to Land's End in Cornwall, and then drove north up to John of Groats. In other words, Land then to John of Groats. Yeah, and then we drove over the top of Scotland and then down the west coast, Isle of Skye. And then we went to Ireland. We spent how long were we in Ireland? You know where Loch Corrib is? You know where Galway is, of course. Well, Galway is at the lower tip of Loch Corrib. And we rented a little cottage in the north shore of Loch Corrib. We spent the winter there. And it's one of the real memorable episodes in our lives. I don't read any science fiction. No taste for whatever. I read murder mysteries and detective stories. And I always prefer the English writers. There's some good American writers, but I think I prefer the English writers. Have you ever read any of M.C. Beaton? Well, she lives, she's a great writer. She lives in Shropshire. And there's two series. She's got the one of them, the locale is a little village on the west coast of Scotland, a little south of Ullapool. And then there's another series she has called the Agatha Raisin series. These are fun, but the other ones are better. They're all got titles like Death of a Snob, Death of a Glutton, Death of a this, Death of a that. But no, you should read them. She's just a remarkable reader, a writer. These books are habit forming. There's a lot of other writers I could mention, but.
Which single science fiction writer has most influenced your own style?
Oh, I can't think of anybody, really. I must say, probably Moore, C.L. Moore, probably.
Which book by another author do you wish you had written?
C.L. Moore? She wrote just short stories, as far as I know. I don't think she's ever written any novels at all. But all her work appeared in the old Weird Tales magazine, which I had when I was a young fellow, you know. We lived in the country then, and every month I'd walk down to the half mile down to the, our post office was called Rural Delivery. And nobody delivered to our house. We had to go to our mailbox, which is... But anyway, I marched down when I expected that book to look in the mailbox, see if Weird Tales had come. But I'll tell you another writer who, not a science fiction writer, is Jeffrey Farnell, one of the best writers that's ever existed. Jeffrey Farnell, F-A-R-N-O-L. He writes not science fiction, but just kind of historical fiction, Regency stories. But he's a marvelous writer. I think they even have, over in England, they have Jeffrey Farnell clubs. Here's a book of fairy tales called East of the Sun, West of the Moon, but it's the most beautiful book that's ever been printed. The illustrations are magnificent. Oh, I like P.G. Woodhouse very much. He's one of my, I think he's a really great writer, and I admire him very much indeed. I don't know. I can't think of any. There's so many books I like and admire, like the ones I've mentioned already, that I can't think of anything especially that I like more than any of the others.
What would be the one question you would ask a science fiction writer?
What question would I nothing. I wouldn't be interested. I don't like science fiction. I think I like my own stuff, but I haven't read any science fiction that I admire at all. The only thing I can remember is Bradbury's Martian Chronicles. That's the only thing that sticks in my head here. I admired that book very much, Martian Chronicles. But aside from that, originally, when I was a kid, first started, there was some, they used to have stories of aliens invading the solar system. John Campbell wrote one of these series, and Williamson, I wrote another one of those things, but those were published when I was 12, 14 years old. Those are, I really like those books there. They're exciting. But I don't care for science fiction to read myself. I don't read any. Never have. Except just picked up a few. But my own writing was, you can hear the dog barking there. Anyway, I'm sorry to be so vague.
For what reason do you write science fiction in preference to other classes of literature?
I have written murder mysteries. Yeah, there's four or five mysteries, but they never sold well. In other words, I didn't make any money off them too much. Got the advance, but I was able to make money off the science fiction, so-called. And I like my own work. I'm not vain exactly, but except that I'm pleased with my own stuff, and I can't think of anything else that I really like. I don't mean this to sound so damn, what's the word, egocentric, but it's just the way it is. I think it might apply to practically everybody. That you ask Silverberg, he probably likes his own work better than anybody else's.
What one aspect of science fiction writing is the most difficult?
Plotting. Just like anything else, you have to... The genre I get up is usually what I don't call it science fiction, I just call it social of human beings in under exotic circumstances, and watch how the culture develops away from the, call them Gaians, Gaeans, Gaian. That's I wrote a lot about the Gaian reach, Earth goddess in Roman as well, Gaia, Gaea. So I call my environment, I just call it the Gaian reach, and I usually the stuff I write is about human beings. Inhabiting new worlds and developing cultural development. That's what interests me, is new culture.
Does it get any easier?
I go through the same work that everybody else does, plotting, which is very important. And of course, getting good characters is very important. But I'm pleased with my last few of them were the ones I liked the best. Ports of Call and Luralu, the last two books I've written. Then I just run out of gas, didn't have any interested writing any more science fiction, but I did knock out the autobiography, and I think that's amusing. I think you'll find it amusing if you ever run into it.
Describe your daily working day.
Oh, what do I do during the day? First of all, I sit and read murder mysteries, and then I'm kind of a musician in a way. I like jazz music. I don't know about you, but I play cornet. I play banjo and ukulele, harmonica, and what I'm doing now is I have a friend that comes over, records me, and I'm creating what I call a shirt tail jazz band, which I'm playing all the instruments, but the putting one on the other, on my friend records them and puts one track over the other one, so I finally get sounds like a whole orchestra, and these things are turning out pretty good. I love jazz music. I think it's the greatest music. I'd like some classical music, but jazz is so much more life to it, and it's so much euphoric and drives, just knocks me out. You got some good orchestras in England. Ralph Barber, one, let me think. Of course, I used to love Ray Noble. And I like Ravel, Scriabin, Vivaldi, Bach. But I must say that Beethoven and Mozart bore me. I'll listen to them, but if I never heard any more in my whole life of those people, I think they're just, I know what direction they're all going in. I just find them tiresome. Whereas the ones I mentioned, Debussy and Ravel, they're got some, they're romantic music, I think. And also, I don't know if you've ever heard any Hawaiian music. You know, you may or may not be aware of what Hawaiian music is. It's music which is loosely based on jazz, but it's got the Hawaiian culture or something. It takes it over, and there's utterly beautiful music. Then I like the gypsy music out of Hungary. I think it's a different kind of music. But let me think, are there any other type? Oh, I like Spanish guitar, not flamenco necessarily, but there's some wonderful Spanish composers that have a lot of guitar in them, which I like very much. Anyway, that's what I like, classical music. Oh, anyway, there's a Scottish band, Jimmy Bland. He's, when we're over there, he's extremely popular. He plays Scottish music, but it's very courtly music. Sometimes there'd be bagpipes involved, but It's accordion, violin, and piano. But Jimmy Bland, I think is that his name, Jimmy? It's delightful music. And again, that's it's Scottish. It has a Scottish feel to it. Anyway,
what's the strangest thing you've ever done while researching?
Oh, nothing very much. I can't think of anything offhand. I know I did some awful strange things when I was growing up. You've heard of the Golden Gate Bridge, I think, probably. But when they were building it, they had these tall towers. And I must have been a teenager then. And I just dared myself to... I had this strange feeling that I want to develop develop myself. So anyway, they have these towers up from which the cables, these are very high towers, and then the cable comes over those, loops down. So I remember one time when they're building the bridge, I dared myself, Jack, climb up that tower. So I waited till night and went down to the foot of where the cable started. By this time, the cable was maybe 2 feet in diameter with the... and had handrails where the workers would walk out to go to work on the bridge. And I remember I got aboard this cable and walked up to the top of the I had a beautiful view over the San Francisco Bay in San Francisco, and it was dark and midnight, and I just walked up there very excited, and then I was going to walk over down the loop over to the second tower, but then I heard some workmen coming my way, so I had to turn around and run back because I didn't want to be caught up there. I like being a merchant seaman. I got into that at the end of the war, and I stayed aboard ships after the war for a period. As I mentioned, I think I cruised all over the South Pacific and New Guinea, Australia. Norm and I, one time, this was after the war, lived in Tahiti. We went down to Tahiti and rented a house down there. Was a beautiful place. This is just what we did. We, Norm and I, traveled a great deal, and we'd rent a house, apartment or something, and I write, and we'd pay our way by, I'd write, and the income we got from the writing allowed us to travel. And we went to Kashmir, rented a houseboat up Kashmir, stayed there while I was writing something, and we went down to Ceylon, they call it Sri Lanka now, and we rented a house in Ceylon down there. And originally, there's a place in the coast of Italy, Positano. You may or may not be aware of it. But that made a great impression on us. This Positano is down the coast from Sorrento, between Sorrento and Amalfi. And anyway, then with Frank Herbert and me, who went down into Mexico, set up a writer's household on Shape Lake Chapala for a while. In other words, I've done a lot of traveling in my life. Love it.
Do you think science fiction as a genre is different from other genres?
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. So it's hard to distinguish science fiction from fantasy. But you can't describe the difference, but you know it when you read it, you know. One of my favorite stuff that I've written is, I call it the Leoness series. There's three books in the Leoness set. I don't know if you ever come in contact with those. Leoness, The Green Pearl, and I forget the name of the... Anyway, that's fantasy, but it's one of the things I'm proud of. There's other things that I like, but I won't go into it too much. Anyway, I don't find reading anybody else's stories at all interesting. I'm too damn fussy myself. I must say that I consider myself a good writer. I have theories as to the craft of writing, which I won't go into the details here, but there are so many writers ignore the craftsmanship of writing science fiction. That they just bore me, and I just, as I mentioned, there's Ray Bradbury's Martian Chronicles I found interesting, and C.L. Moore.
What do you consider the chief value of science fiction?
Well, it opens your mind to the possibilities of the human possibilities. Of course, a lot of it is so much nonsense, foolishness. But on the other hand, as on Earth as we know it now, there are so many different cultures: Chinese, Indian, and then of course, let me think. Where else on the Pacific Islands? These are all different ways of life, and of course the States and England and. In France, I love France. I don't know, do you travel in France yourself? I love the south of France. When we travel in France, we travel by the Michelin guide. If you ever use the Michelin, there's one for England as well. In fact, I know there is. It rates all the restaurants and the hotels. And it's just so much fun using the Michelin guide to travel by. If you know what I'd like to do? Yeah, I never have done this, but I'm mad that I haven't done. What I'd like to do is have a car and get drop off at Southampton, and then drive up north through England, going to all the old inns and old taverns, that and just go on up. Scotland and Ireland, the taverns aren't picturesque or interesting, but the English, old English taverns, are so beautiful. In fact, in my house here, I've got one room is set up with a bar in it, and I set it up because it's like an English tavern. It's got a fireplace, one end, and a bar, and horse brasses all over the bar. And have you ever read any of Marcia Grimes, writer? All her books, most of them, she names the books after some English tavern. Very good books, very entertaining anyway.
Has science fiction ever disappointed you?
When I try to write something and send it in and I couldn't sell it or only get a half a cent a word on it or something. But when I was pleased with something I written, that more than compensates for the times that I... There's a lot of my early stuff that I don't like very much. Early short stories that I think are... I'm not proud of at all. But the longer I worked at it, the better I consider my books to be. This is a natural development, of course. But I learned the craft of writing, so to speak. So at the end of my career, so to speak, I was pleased with the stuff that I'd written.
Is there still new ground to be covered in science fiction literature?
I don't know. I doubt it. I haven't the slightest idea. I haven't read any science fiction for 30, 40 years. I don't know what people are writing nowadays. For all I know, maybe there's a lot of good stuff going on. I don't know. I don't have a clue. I just read the murder mysteries.
Jack Vance, thank you so much.
Well, let me think. Oh, I wanted to ask you, have you ever been over here in the States?
We came to the Vermont, you know, we stayed around Maine and Vermont, and we stayed there.
If you come out, have you ever been in California?
No, we haven't, no.
Well, come to California and stay with us.
Oh, that would be awesome.
We could, you could bring your whole family over and visit. I'd be delighted to have you over here.
Oh, Jack, that's a lovely offer. Thank you so much. It's just, like you say, it's in this day and age, you know, to get my family up and over there, it costs a small fortune, and we've got the real world in, you know, we're getting a new bathroom fitted in the house, so that's taken up all the money this year. But that's a lovely kind offer. Thank you so much.
Well, no, take me seriously. I'd love to have you over here.
Oh, Jack, that's a lovely offer.
And California is such a beautiful state. There's so much wonderful things here in California. the beautiful, beautiful scenery. I live right across the bay from San Francisco in Oakland, which is up in the hills across the bay from San Francisco. But, there's so much in California that I won't take the trouble. I won't bore you with it.
Oh, no.
Description of it.
I'm interested to find out about your house. So you built your house, you and your son just built your house by yourselves?
I beg your pardon?
You know,
you built my house?
Yes.
Yes, I did, and it's a large place. When we first got this property here, we got it very cheap, and there was a little shack on it, and we moved into this I can't call it a cottage. It was just nothing very much, but we got to work and moved in, and then started building our new house around it. And as we built, we'd throw the old house out the window, and finally, we got so there's nothing in the old shack in here now at all. I'm very pleased with our house. It's three stories on it. Three floors, I guess you'd call it. And it's very spacious. Very pleasant, I think. Where how do you support yourself? What kind of business you in?
I work for the local water industry, the water company over here. So I'll take say reservoir water, and in my plant where I work, it turns it into drinking water.
Yeah.
Yeah, and where I live on just right on the edge, right on the northeast coast, a little fishing village, right on the northeast coast of England. And it's lovely as well. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes we get some horrible weather through the winter.
That's
you know.
Yorkshire.
No, a little bit further up, the northeast of England.
Northeast. That's Yorkshire.
A bit further, not exactly Scotland. Just on the kind of really on the borders of Scotland, just before Scotland.
Up near Hadrian's Wall.
Yes, yes, not far from there. I'll actually live on the coast where Wall's End, that's where Hadrian's Wall starts. It's not far from Wall's End.
One time I was invited to a convention in Sweden, and I drove up, let me think, I rented a car down in Southampton, and went over a ship and rented a car and drove up, I think, up to a town up near Hadrian's Wall, and from there I turned in, I forget now whether maybe I took public transportation, it makes no difference, it must have been, I must have come up on the train or the bus. But to a port there, I forget the name of it, but there a ferry connects this port with Norway. Undoubtedly, you know it if I mentioned it.
It's not the River Tyne, Newcastle, is it? Is that?
My Newcastle, yeah.
Yeah, that's my city.
a ferry runs to Norway.
Yes, it does. Yes, it comes through. Well, the River Tyne is probably where you get the ferry from. Is probably 4 miles away from my
it's
house.
Been so long, I've forgotten. But it was awful. We stayed at. I was alone, but this Norma didn't come with me on this trip. But I was there by myself. Came up from East Anglia. up the east coast of England and up into Newcastle, and then took the ferry over to Norway and spent the whole maybe a month in Norway, and then went over to Stockholm, went to the convention in Stockholm, and down to get home, went down through Denmark, or just actually I just went Copenhagen, and then from Copenhagen home.
What was it like, you know, when you said you went with Frank Herbert and you lived in a house in Mexico, and Frank, what was all that about?
Well, it was a lake, there's a lake, Chapala, and we rented a house down there, and we thought we could sell enough stuff to keep us going, but for some reason, this was before Frank wrote Dune, but we thought we could, but at that time, just before this time, I was writing a television program called Captain Video, and I thought I could sell these Captain Video scripts in Mexico. But just about this time, I forget the circumstances now, but anyway, they weren't taking the Captain Video scripts anymore. And I wrote some other stuff, but it was just a drought. Couldn't make any money. And we had to slink home, both of us. Frank went up to Seattle, and I went to Oakland. Frank went back, ultimately he went back to Mexico. He came down in a hearse. You know what a hearse is?
Yes.
He drove down past our house in hearse, went down to Mexico, and converted the hearse to a station wagon. And then he ultimately came back. Then Cole Anderson, Frank, and I, we started building a houseboat. See, up in where we live, there's a lot of rivers and tributaries, and so anyway, we started work on this houseboat. Just about got it through, and then suddenly a big storm came up, and I won't go through all the details here, but anyway, the thing sank, and it was just about done. But Paul Anderson, he was a marvelous, marvelous man. He's one of my great friends, a man I admire tremendously. And his writing was, I think, kind of spotty. But Frank, he threw in the towel. He just gave up. He said, I'm out of this. I don't want to. But Paul and I, we raised this houseboat and took it up the river. And then we had that for just marvelous. It was so beautiful. Just think about the old houseboat with such wonderful memories. But finally, I gave it away to Norm and I sold a set of stories for $4,000, enough to take us over to Europe. And I gave away my share in the houseboat to Hungarian that was wanted to trying to get set up professional soccer league here in California. Never took on, but he sank the houseboat again. That's the last I saw of it.
Right, and it sank, and that was it. Was it?
Yeah. Hold on, just a minute, John. Oh. I'm just talking to this friend.
Well, no, listen, Jack, I've kept you so long, and it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing your life with myself and me listeners. It's been lovely.
Well, I can't complain. I'm getting a little long in the tooth now, but...
How old are you now then, Jack?
I am 93.
Wow! Go on. And are you still fit and well? Is everything okay in health-wise?
I lost my eyesight. I don't know if you know that or not.
Yes, I'd heard that.
Yeah. But I'm more or less healthy. I'm certainly, I don't think I'm senile yet. And I have all my teeth. Yeah, I'm pretty good health. I'm not obese. I'm pretty good physical shape. And I'm more or less healthy.
Well, that's
how about you?
Yes, that's lovely to hear with you, Jack, yes. Well, hopefully, touch wood, I'm fine. I'm 44, so... And, you know, I don't think I'm...
I'm 44. I'm more than twice your age.
Yes.
Think of that.
I know. It's strange how life just goes round and round. It's amazing. But yeah.
Yeah.
But you sound fit and well. That's the main thing. You know what I mean? Because you just...
Oh, no. I got all my wits about me still. I enjoy being alive. I can't live forever, of course. But and I can't complain.
It's nice to know that Silverberg still pops up and sees you.
What's about Silverberg?
He still comes up and sees you.
I see him about once every month or two. He comes up to our house up here. In fact, it's about time I was having Silverberg up again. I haven't seen him for a couple months now.
Well, I asked those questions to Robert Silverberg, and he gives some lovely answers as well, you know. So it's been really nice because those questions I've asked to a number of writers, and it's nice to see the difference, you know, what different writers come up with.
Oh, yeah. Silverberg and we get along well enough. But he lives such a different life from mine. He's done a lot of traveling, too. He's got a very nice wife. He has no kids, Silverberg. But there's so many amusing episodes in his life that I... About time I was having him over.
And so have you not read any Robert Silverberg books, Ed? Have you never read a story by... Bob Silverberg?
I don't remember ever. I must have, but it's been so long ago. Certainly not in 30 or 40 years. I haven't. Essentially, I must say that I have. Oh, I remember one story I read by him, but it wasn't science fiction. It was a historical book, something about the Istanbul or the Turks or something like that. I forget what it was. I've forgotten it, but anyway... But I haven't read much by And I haven't read Frank Herbert either. Frank, well,
so you
made a lot of money.
You haven't read Dune, have you not?
No, I never read it.
Well, there's something in common, because I never have as well.
No, his son, Brian, is still turning out these Dune books.
Yes, so I've...
The funny thing is, when Frank and I were down in Chapala, Mexico, and Frank, we're sitting out on our front porch drinking beer there, and Frank said, I got a wonderful idea for a novel. It's about a dry planet, and the people there, they mine spice. It's dry, and they write spice. And he was looking off over across the lake there, Lake Chapala. And I didn't think, I thought, geez, I don't think this is going to, he's going to waste his time on this. So I remember telling them, say, I didn't want to say outright that, Frank, this is a silly idea, foolishness. But I kind of hinted. I said, well, I don't know about that, Frank. I don't know about that. This, that. And he was looking off across the distance. And then the funny thing is, when he first published Dune, he said, I have Jack Vance to thank for inspiring me. He thought I didn't encourage him to write Dune when I was trying to discourage him. But he didn't pay any attention to me. He was looking off vaguely, looking across. Frank was an awful strange fellow, I tell you. I had so many anecdotes in regard to Frank Herbert that I can't say that I admired him personally very much. He had some good qualities to him, but he was, Frank was such a, oh, well, for instance, Frank learned to play. Do you know who George Gershwin is?
Yes, I've heard. Well, I don't know his music, but I've heard the name.
Yeah, well, George Gershwin wrote a thing called Rhapsody in Blue, and it's a kind of classical music, but it's pretty stuff. But Frank was not a musician, but somehow he learned the first bar or two bars of this Rhapsody in Blue. He couldn't play it, but he sedulously worked so he could play. Da, 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 da. And that was the first couple bars of this Rhapsody in Blue. And that's all he could play. But he had a little trick of I've seen him do this three or four times when he had friends coming over. He'd sit at the piano, and as they came up the front door, he'd hit his first three chords. And then by this time, the people would be coming in the house, and Frank would stop and turn, looking at him, you know, grinning, and say, you know, as if, oh, yes. They said, oh, Frank, continue. And Frank would laugh at him and chuckle. Never said, that's all I can play. But he just acted, I'm too modest to continue playing. he was such a... He had many good qualities, but I never admired personally very much. I thought he was kind of a, well.
65 when he died as well.
He had many good qualities. But for instance, when her houseboat went down, he didn't. He said, "Ah, I've had it," and walked away. And Paul and I had to raise the thing, which we did. Paul was such a wonderful guy. I admire him very much. I can't say enough about him. He had a lovely mother, too. She was a delightful old lady. But his wife, she was a hellhound. She's still alive. Karen. Have you ever met her?
No.
She's a strange lady. Well, let me think. Anything else you want to discuss?
No, Jack, it's been lovely just talking to you. It's just sitting here listening to you has been just fantastic. It's been so nice. Thank you so much.
Well, it's nice talking to you.
It's yes, honestly, thank you. And I just like say, I hope your good health remains for many years to come.
Hope. Naturally, I don't want to turn my toes up too soon. I was just reading a book. There's a man called John Edward. He's one of these spiritualists, and I just happened to hit on a book that he wrote, and he's talking about people come in and communicates with, communicates with the dead. Spirits talk to him. And this book is so convincing. But this friend of mine just come through. He says, well, he's a fake, a fraud. But I don't know. I'm not a spiritualist. I don't necessarily endorse the idea of spirits, but there's so many mediums, and there's so many frauds involved here. But who knows? You know, you have these poltergeists. Have you ever run into a poltergeist?
No, and it's funny. I don't know which way I sit with all, looking at the spiritualists.
You're supposed to have them all over England.
Yes,
poltergeist.
It's what they say.
Poltergeist come from the German word noisy ghost.
I'm actually scared of the dark as well, so that doesn't help.
But apparently, they have poltergeists here in the States, but I've never run into anything of the sort. But I've got an open mind. I'm not religious at all. I'm not. Well, I'm just an atheist, essentially. But who knows what's going on? Maybe there is an old man with white whiskers sitting out somewhere on a planet of his own, watching down, looking at things that are going on here in the world, making decisions, being kind to people, breeding Jesus Christ. But I don't know. I can't believe it. As I mentioned, I'm an atheist. But religion has been a source of comfort for an awful lot of people. And on the other hand, it's been a source of so many horrible things that have happened in the name of religion, starting with the Crusades, the 30 Years' War, the Spanish Inquisition. Well,
Jack, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you so much.
Well, don't forget, get your family, bring your family over and, visit us.
That would be, that's a lovely gesture. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it'd be a pleasure. All right.
Jack, take good care.
If you ever want to call again, do so.
Oh, I would love to, yes. It would be, I mean, if that's okay, I would love to call again. You know what I mean? I'll certainly get some more questions and, you know, talk about the old days. And because it's nice just talking about the old science fiction writers, you know, the older guys as well, different questions. But I've certainly kept you too long this time. So thank you so much.
All right, not at all. Nice talking to you.
Yes, have a lovely day, and thank you so much.
Same to you.
Take good care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
There you go. Do you know, it's actually hard to you know, have an outro to that interview. I was just left... Do you know what I mean? Actually, when I give you a little background to the interview, you know, I was expecting, to be quite honest, a couple of days before that, I did the Ray Bradbury interview, and I'll play that, you know, very soon. The Ray Bradbury interview lasted 2 minutes, if that. Do you know? I wasn't expecting Jack Vance to put in such a fantastic, you know, interview. I was expecting, you know, a couple of minutes, maybe five, and I would have been very happy with that, do you know? And actually... You know, the family was waiting for us as well. You know, they're upstairs. I says, Melanie, I'll be a couple of minutes and I'll, you know, we'll come up and we'll read a story I think we're going to do. You know, like I say, it was over an hour and I've edited little bits out, you know, so it was well over an hour. And I was just left, you know, it just knocked me sideways, that interview. I was just humbled by this great man. Do you know, what a sweet, gentle man. And he's inviting us over, you know what I mean? Doesn't happen, no. That doesn't happen in the real world. Do you know, it's just lovely, lovely man. Please spread the word about this interview. I just want everyone to hear it. You know, I want everyone to kind of know about, I know everyone knows about Jack Vance, but just, I bet there's not many kind of audio interviews out there with him. This one is special. Please pass the word. Next up is Kim Stanley Robinson with a story called Mercurial. And again, this is, you know, one of the big hitters in the science fiction world. Born in 1952, American science fiction writer. If you actually trawl back through the archives of Starships Over Orwell's Lights, The English Assassin does a lovely in-depth review of some of Kim Stanley Robinson's works. But I'll just give you a little heads up. We had the Mars trilogy, Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, The Orange County, The Wild Shore, The Gold Coast and Pacific Edge. I actually got that in hardback, first edition. Novels, The Year of Rice and Salt is one of them, and this came out in 2009, Galileo's Dream. He started writing short fiction in somewhere around 1976. And his last one, according to the Internet Science Fiction Database, is Prometheus Unbound at Last, 2007. Kim Stanley Robinson has won 11 of the major science fiction awards. He has won the Hugo Award for Best Novel for Green Mars in 1994, then Blue Mars in 1997. The Nebula Award for Best Novel with Red Mars, 1993. The World Fantasy Award with Black Air, came out in 1983. Then the John W. Campbell Award for Best Science Fiction with Pacific Edge, 1991. He's won the Locus Award for a number of books. The Wild Shore, 1985. A Sharp, Sharp Shock, 1990. Get the S's right. Green Mars, 1994. Blue Mars, 1997. And The Martians, 2000. And finally, with The Years of Rice and Salt, 2003. Like I say, do trawl back through the archives and listen to English Assassin on Kim Stanley Robinson. It is a great little in-depth review of the man's work. This story is narrated by Peter Seaton Clark, who runs Ofstimer, which provides professional experienced voiceover artists for the broadcasting industry in Germany and all over Europe. Pete has been such a great help to Starship so far. He was part of the James Morrow story with his wife, Nicola Seton Clark, and they did that fantastic narration. And he's done a number of narrations and more coming up in the future as well. So I'll put a link on to Offstimmer. Please pop over there and just have a look at Peter's work over there as well. Fantastic. So the Starship Sova and her oral delight is very proud to present.
Mercurial by Kim Stanley Robinson.
She rules all of Oz,
said Dorothy.
And so she rules your city and you, because you are in the Winkie Country, which is part of the Land of Oz.
It may be, returned the High Coco Lorum, for we do not study geography, and have never inquired whether we live in the Land of Oz or not. Any ruler who rules us from a distance, and unknown to us, is welcome to the job. L. Frank Baum, The Lost Princess of Oz. I am not, despite the appearances, fond of crime detection. In the past, it is true, I occasionally accompanied my friend Freya Grindavik as she solved her cases, and admittedly this Watsoning gave me some good material for the little tales I have written for the not very discriminating markets on Mars and Titan. But after the case of the Golden Sphere of the Lion of Mercury, in which I ended up hung by the feet from the clear dome of Terminator, 200 meters above the rooftops of the city, my native lack of enthusiasm rose to the fore. And following the unfortunate adventure of the Vulcan accelerator, when Freya's arch-foe Jan Johansson tied us to a pile of hay under a large magnifying glass in a survival tent, there to await Mercury's fierce dawn, I put my foot down. No more detecting. That, so to speak, was the last straw. So when I agreed to accompany Freya to the Solday party of Heidi van Seegeren, it was against my better judgment. But Freya assured me there would be no business involved, and despite the obvious excesses, I enjoy a Solday party as much as the next aesthete. So when she came by my villa, I was ready. "Make haste," she said. "We're late, and I must be before Heidi's Monet when the great gates are opened. I adore that painting." "Your infatuation is no secret," I said, panting as I trailed her through the crowded streets of the city. Freya, as those of you who have read my earlier tales know, is 2.5 meters tall and broad-shouldered. She barged through the shoals of Solday celebrants rather like a whale, and I, pilot-fish-like, dodged in her wake. She led me through a group of greys.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With carpet beaters were busy pounding rugs saturated with yellow dust. As I coughed and brushed off my fine burgundy suit, I said, My feeling is that you have taken me to view that antique canvas once or twice too often. She looked at me sternly. As you will see, on Sol Day it transcends even its usual beauty. You look like a bee drowning in pollen, Nathaniel. Whose fault is that? I demanded, brushing my suit fastidiously. We came to the gate in the wall surrounding Van Seegeren's town villa, and Freya banged on it loudly. The gate was opened by a scowling man. He was nearly a meter shorter than Freya, and had a balding head that bulged rather like the dome of the city. In a mincing voice he said, "Invitations?" "What's this?" said Freya. "We have permanent invitations from Heidi." "I'm sorry," the man said coolly. "Miss Van Seegeren has decided her Sol Day parties have gotten overcrowded, and this time she sent out invitations and instructed me to let in only those who have them." "Then there has been a mistake," Freya declared. "Get Heidi on the intercom and she will instruct you to let me in. I am Freya Grindavik, and this is Nathaniel Sebastian." "I'm sorry," the man said, quite unapologetically. "Every person turned away says the same thing, and Miss Van Seegeren prefers not to be disturbed so frequently." "She'll be more disturbed to hear we've been held up." Freya shifted towards the man. "Who are you, anyway?" "I am Sandor Musgrave, Miss Van Seegeren's private secretary." "How come I've never met you?" "Miss Van Seegeren hired me 2 months ago," Musgrave said, and stepped back so he could look Freya in the eye without straining his neck. "That is immaterial, however. I've been Heidi's friend for over 40 years, Freya said slowly, once again shifting forward to lean over the man. "And I would wager she values her friends more than her secretaries." Musgrave stepped back indignantly. "I'm sorry," he snapped. "I have my orders. Good day." But alas for him, Freya was now standing well in the gateway, and she seemed uninclined to move. She merely cocked her head at him. Musgrave comprehended his problem, and his mouth twitched uncertainly. The impasse was broken when Van Seegeren's maid, Lucinda, arrived from the street.
"Oh, hello, Freya. Nathaniel. What are you doing out here?"
"This new Malvolio of yours is barring our entrance," Freya said.
"Oh, Musgrave," said Lucinda. "Let these two in or the boss will be mad."
Musgrave retreated with a deep scowl. "I've studied the ancients, Miss Grindavik," he said sullenly. "You need not insult me." "Malvolio was a tragic character," Freya assured him. "Read Charles Lamb's essay concerning the matter." "I certainly will," Musgrave said stiffly, and hurried to the villa, giving us a last poisonous look. "Of course, Lamb's father," Freya said absently, staring after the man, "was a house servant."
"Lucinda, who is that?"
Lucinda rolled her eyes.
"The boss hired him to restore some of her paintings and get the records in order. Oh, I wish he hadn't."
The bell in the gate sounded.
"I've got it, Musgrave,"
Lucinda shouted at the villa. She opened the gate, revealing the artist, Harvey Washburn.
"So you do,"
said Harvey, blinking. He was high again, a bottle of the White Brother hung from his hand.
"Freya, Nathaniel, happy Sol Day to you. Have a drink."
We refused the offer, and then followed Harvey around the side of the villa, exchanging a glance. I felt sorry for Harvey. Most of Mercury's great collectors came to Harvey's showings, but they dissected his every brushstroke for influences and told him what he should be painting. And then amongst themselves they called his work amateurish and unoriginal and never bought a single canvas. I was never surprised to see him drinking. We rounded the side of the big villa and stepped onto the white stone patio, which was made of a giant slab of England's Dover cliffs, cut out and transported to Mercury entire. Malvolio Musgrave had spoken the truth about Heidi reducing the size of her Sol Day party. Where often the patio had been jammed, there were now less than a dozen people. I spotted George Butler, Heidi's friend and rival art collector, and Arnold Oman, the art dealer who obtained for many of Mercury's collectors their ancient masterpieces from Earth. As I greeted them, Freya led us all across the patio to the back wall of the villa, which was also fronted with white slabs of the Dover Cliffs. There, all alone, hung Claude Monet's Rouen Cathedral, Sun Effect.
"Look at it, Nathaniel," Freya commanded me. "Isn't it beautiful?"
I looked at it. Now, you must understand that as owner of the Gallery Orientale, and by deepest personal aesthetic conviction, I am a connoisseur of Chinese art, a style in which a dozen artfully spontaneous brushstrokes can serve to delineate a mountain or two, several trees, a small village and its inhabitants, and perhaps some birds. Given my predilection, you will not be surprised to learn that merely to look at the antique rectangle of colour that Freya so admired was to risk damaging my eyes. Thick, scumbled layers of grainy paint scarcely revealed the cathedral of the title, which wavered under a blast of light so intense that I doubted Mercury's midday could compete with it. Small blobs of every colour served to represent both the indistinct stone and a pebbly sky. Both were composed of combinations principally of white, yellow and purple, though, as I say, every other colour made an appearance. "Stunning," I said, with a severe squint. "Are you sure this Monet wasn't a bit nearsighted?" Freya glared at me, ignoring Butler's chuckles.
"I suppose your comment might have been funny the first time you made it, to children, anyway."
"But I heard it was actually true," I said, shielding my eyes with one hand. "Monet was nearsighted, and so, like Goya, his vision affected his painting."
"I should hope so,"
Harvey said solemnly. "So all he could see were those blobs of colour. Isn't that sad?" Freya shook her head.
"You won't get a rise out of me today, Nathaniel. You'll have to think up your dinner conversation by yourself."
Momentarily stopped by this riposte, I retired with Arnold Oman to Heidi's patio bar. After dialing drinks from the bartender, we sat on the blocks of Dover Cliffs that made up the patio's low outer wall. We toasted Solde and contemplated the clouds of yellow talc that swirled over the orange tile rooftops below us. For those of you that have never visited it, Terminator is an oval city. The forward half of the city is flat and projects out under the clear dome. The rear half of the oval is terraced and rises to the tall Dawn Wall, which supports the upper rim of the dome and shields the city from the perpetually rising sun. The great gates of Terminator are near the top of the Dawn Wall, and when they are opened, shafts of Sol's overwhelming light spear through the city's air, illuminating everything in a yellow brilliance. Heidi Van Seegeren's villa was about halfway up the terraced slope. We looked upon grey stone walls, orange tile roofs, and the dusty vines and lemon trees of the terrace gardens that dotted the city. Outside the dome, the 12 big tracks over which the city slid extended off to the horizon, circling the planet like a slender silver wedding band. It was a fine view, and I lifted my glass to the idea that Claude Monet wasn't there to paint it. For sometimes, if you ask me, reality is enough. Oman downed his drink in one swallow. Rumour had it that he was borrowing heavily to finance one of his big Terran purchases. It was whispered he was planning to buy the closed portion of the Louvre, or the Renaissance room of the Vatican Museum, or Amsterdam's Van Gogh collection. But rumours like that circulated round Arnold continuously. He was that kind of dealer. It was unlikely any of them were true. Still, his silence seemed to reveal a certain tension. "Look at the way Freya is soaking in that painting you got for Heidi," I said, to lift his spirits. Freya's face was within centimetres of the canvas, where she could examine it blob by blob. The people behind her could see nothing but her white blonde hair. Oman smiled at the sight. He had brought the Monet back from his most recent Terran expedition, and apparently it had been a great struggle to obtain it. Both the English family that owned it and the British government had had to be paid enormous sums to secure its release, and only the fact that Mercury was universally considered humanity's greatest art museum had cleared the matter with the courts. It had been one of Arnold's finest hours. "Now," he said,
Maybe we should pull her away a bit so that others can see.
If both of us tug on her, it may work, I said. We stood and went to her side. Harvey Washburn, looking flushed and frazzled, joined us, and we convinced Freya to share the glory. Omen and Butler conferred over something, and entered the villa through the big French doors that led into the concert room. Inside, Heidi's orchestra rolled up and down the scales of Mussorgsky's Hutter Baba Yaga. That meant it was close to the time when the great gates would open. Heidi always gets inside information about this. Sure enough, as Mussorgsky's composition burst from the hut of Baba Yaga into the great gates of Kiev, two splinters of white light split the air under the dome. Shouts and fanfares rose everywhere, nearly drowning the amplified sound of our orchestra. Slowly the great gates opened, and as they did, the shafts of light grew to thick, buttery gold bars of air. By their rich, nearly blinding glare, Heidi van Siegeren made her first entrance from her villa, timing her steps to the exaggerated Mazel Retard that her conductor, Hugh, employed every Sol Day when Pictures at an Exhibition was performed. This retard shifted the music from the merely grandiose to the utterly bombastical, and it took Heidi over a minute to cross her own narrow patio. But I suppose it was not entirely silly, given the ritual nature of the moment, and the flood of light that was making the air appear a thick, quite tangible gel. What with the light and the uproar created by the Keening Greys, and the many orchestras in the neighbourhood each playing their own overture or fanfare, the Coriolan came from one side of us, the 1812 from the other. It was a complex, and I might even say noisy, aesthetic moment. And the last thing I needed was to take another look at the Monet monstrosity. But Freya would not have it otherwise.
"You've never seen it when the great gates are opened," she said. "That was the whole point in bringing you here today."
"I see." Actually, I barely saw anything. As Freya had guided me by the arm to the painting, I'd accidentally looked directly at the incandescent yellow bars of sunlight, and brilliant blue afterimages bounced in my sight. I heard rather than saw Harvey Washburn join us. Many blinks later, I was able to join the others in devoting my attention to the big canvas. Well, the Monet positively glowed in the dense, lambent air. It gave off light like a lamp, vibrating with a palpable energy of its own. At the sight of it, even I was impressed. "Yes," I admitted to Freya and Harvey. "I can see how precisely he placed all those little chunks of colour, and I can see how sharp and solid the cathedral is under all that goo. But it's like Sol Day, you know? It's a heightened effect. The result is garish, really. It's too much."
"But this is a painting of midday," Harvey said. "And as you can see, midday can get pretty garish."
"But this is Terminator. The Greys have put a lot of talc into the air to make it look that way."
"So what?" Freya demanded impatiently. "Stop thinking so much, Nathaniel. Just look at it. See it. Isn't it beautiful? Haven't you felt things look that way sometimes, seeing stone in sunlight?"
"Well, and since I'm a strictly honest person, if I had said anything at all, I would have had to admit that it did have a power about it. It drew the eye. It poured light onto us as surely as the beams of sunlight extending from the gates in the dawn wall to the curved side of the clear dome."
"Well?" Freya demanded.
"Well, yes," I said. "Yes, I see that cathedral front. I feel it. But there must have been quite a heatwave in old Rouen. It's as if Monet had seen Terminator on Sol Day. The painting fits so well with this light."
"No,"
Freya said. But her left eye was squinted, a sign she is thinking.
Harvey said, "We make the conditions of light in Terminator, so it's an act of the imagination like this painting. You shouldn't be surprised if there are similarities. We value this light because the old masters created it on their canvases."
I shook my head and indicated the brassy bedlam around us.
"No, I believe we made this one up ourselves."
Freya and Harvey laughed with the giddiness that Sol Day inspires. Suddenly, a loud screech came from inside the villa. Freya hurried across the patio into the music room, and I followed her.
Both of us, however, had forgotten the arrangements that Heidi made on Sol days to cast the brilliant light throughout her home, and as we ran past the silenced orchestra into a hallway, we were blasted by light from a big mirror carefully placed in the villa's central atrium. Screams still echoed from somewhere inside, but we could only stumble blindly through bright, pulsing afterimages, retinal monets, if you will, while unidentified persons bowled into us and mirrors crashed to the floor. And the atrium was raised, so that occasional steps up in the hallway tripped us.
"Murder!" someone cried. "Murder! There he goes!"
And with that, the whole group of us were off down the halls like hounds, blind hounds baying after unknown prey. A figure leaped from behind a mirror glaring white, and Freya and I tackled it just inside the atrium. When my vision swam back, I saw it was George Butler. "What's going on?" he asked, very politely for a man who had just been jumped on by Freya Grindvik.
"Don't ask us," Freya said irritably. "Murder!" shrieked Lucinda from the hallway that led from the atrium directly back to the patio.
We jumped up and crowded into the hallway. Just beyond a mirror, shattered into many pieces, lay a man's body. Apparently he'd been crawling towards the patio when he collapsed, and one arm and finger extended ahead of him, pointing to the patio still. Freya approached, gingerly turned the body's head.
"It's that Musgrave fellow," she said, blinking to clear her sight. "He's dead, all right. Struck on the head with the mirror there, no doubt."
Heidi Van Seegeren joined us.
"What's going on?"
"That was my question," George Butler said. Freya explained the situation to her.
"Call the police," Heidi said to Lucinda, "and I suppose no one should leave."
I sighed. And so crime detection ensnared me once again. I helped Freya by circulating on the patio, calming the shocked and nervous guests.
Excuse me. Very sorry to inform you. Yes, sorry.
Hard to believe. Yes. Somebody had it in for the Secretary Musgrave, it appears. All the while watching to see if anyone would jump or turn pale or start to run when I told them. Then, of course, I had to lead gently to the idea that everyone had gone from guest to suspect, soon to be questioned by Freya and the police.
"Oh, no, of course you're not suspected of anything. Furthest thing from our minds. It's just that Freya wants to know if there's anything you saw that would help," and so on.
Then I had to do the difficult scheduling of Freya's interviews. At the same time, I was supposed to keep an eye out for anything suspicious. Oh, the Watson does the dirty work, all right. No wonder we always look dense when the detective unveils the solutions. We never have the time even to get the facts straight, much less meditate on their meaning. All I got that day were fragments. Lucinda whispered to me that Musgrave had worked for George Butler before Heidi hired him. Harvey Washburn told me that Musgrave had once been an artist, and that he had only recently moved to Mercury from Earth. This was his first Sol day. That didn't give him much time to be hired by Butler, fired, and then hired by Van Seegeren. But was that of significance? Late in the day I spoke with one of the police officers handling the case. She was relieved to have the help of Freya Grindvik. Terminator's police force is small and often relies on the help of the city's famous detective for more difficult cases. The officer gave me a general outline of what they had learned. Lucinda had heard a shout for help, had stepped into the atrium and seen a bloodied figure crawling down the hallway towards the patio. She had screamed and run for help, but only in the hallway was clear vision possible, and she had quickly gotten lost. After that, chaos. Everyone at the party had a different tale of confusion. After that conversation, I had nothing more to do, so I got all the sequestered guests' coffee and helped pick up some of the broken hall mirrors and pass some time prowling Heidi's villa, getting down on my hands and knees with the police robots to inspect a stain or two. When Freya was finished with her interrogations, she promised Heidi and the police that she would see the case to its end, at least provisionally.
"I only do this for entertainment," she told them irritably. "I'll stay with it as long as it entertains me, and I shall entertain myself with it."
"That's all right," said the police, who had heard this before, "just so long as you'll take the case." Freya nodded and we left.
The Sol Day celebration was long since over. The great gates were closed, and once again through the dome shone the black sky. I said to Freya, "Did you hear about Musgrave working for Butler, and how he came from Earth just recently?" For you see, once on the scent, I am committed to seeing a case solved. "Please, Nathaniel," Freya said. "I heard all that and more. Musgrave stole the concept of Harvey Washburn's first series of paintings. He blackmailed both Butler and our host Heidi to obtain his jobs from them, or so I deduce from their protestations and certain facts concerning their recent questionable merger that I'm privy to. And he tried to assault Lucinda, who is engaged to the cook de Laurence." She let out a long sigh. "Motives are everywhere." "It seems this Musgrave was a thoroughly despicable sort," I said. "Yes, an habitual blackmailer. Nothing suggests itself to you?" "No, I don't know why I agree to solve these things. Here I am committed to this head-bashing, and my best clue is something that you suggested." I wasn't aware that I'd suggested anything. "There is a fresh perspective to ignorance that can be very helpful." "So it is important that Musgrave just arrived from Earth?" She laughed. "Let's stop at the Plaza Dubrovnik and get something to eat. I'm starving." Almost 3 weeks passed without a word from Freya, and I began to suspect that she was ignoring the case. Freya has no real sense of right and wrong, you see. She regards her cases as games to be tossed aside if they prove too taxing. More than once she has cheerfully admitted defeat and blithely forgotten any promises she may have made. She is not a moral person. So I dropped by her home near Plaza Dubrovnik one evening to rouse her from her irresponsible indifference. When she answered the door, there were paint smudges on her face and hands. "Freya," I scolded her, "how could you take up an entirely new hobby when there is a case to be solved?" "Generously, I allow you entrance after such a false accusation," she said, "but you will have to eat your words." She led me downstairs to her basement laboratory, which extended the entire length and breadth of her villa. There on a big white-topped table lay Heidi van Siegeren's Monet, looking like the three-dimensional geological map of some minerally blessed country. "What's this?" I exclaimed. "Why is this here?" "I believe it is a fake," she said shortly, returning to a computer console. "Wait a moment," I cried. On the table around the painting were rolls of recording chart paper, lab notebooks, and what looked like black-and-white photos of the painting. "What do you mean?" After tapping at the console, she turned to me. "I mean, I believe it's a fake." "But I thought art forgery was extinct. It is too easy to discover a fake." "Ha!" She waved a finger at me angrily. "You pick a bad time to say so. It is a common opinion, of course, but not necessarily true." I regarded the canvas more closely. "What makes you think this is a fake? I thought it was judged a masterpiece for its period." "Something you said first caused me to question it," she said. "You mentioned that the painting seemed to have been created by an artist familiar with the light of Terminator. This seemed true to me, and it caused me to reflect that one of the classic signs of a fake was anachronistic sensibility. That is to say, the forger injects into his vision of the past some element of his time that is so much a part of his sensibility that he cannot perceive it. Thus, the Victorians faked Renaissance faces with a sentimentality that only they could not immediately see." "I see," I nodded sagely. "It did seem that cathedral had been struck with Sol Day light, didn't it?" "Yes. The trouble is, I have been able to find no sign of forgery in the physical properties of the painting." She shook her head. "And after 3 weeks of uninterrupted chemical analysis, that is beginning to worry me." "But Freya," I said, as something occurred to me, "does all this have a bearing on the Musgrave murder?" "I think so," she replied. "And if not, it is certainly more interesting. But I believe it does." I nodded. "So what exactly have you found?" She smiled ironically. "You truly want to know?"
The best test for anachronisms is the polonium-210 radium-226 equilibrium. Please, Freya, no jargon. Jargon? She raised an eyebrow to scorn me. There is no such thing. Intelligence is like mould in a petri dish. As it eats ever deeper into the agar of reality, language has to expand with it to describe what has been digested. Each speciality provides the new vocabulary for its area of feeding and gets accused of fabricating jargon by those who know no better. I am surprised to hear such nonsense from you. Or perhaps not. Very well, I said, hands up. Still, you must communicate your meaning to me. I shall. First, I analysed the canvas. The material and its weave matched the characteristics of the canvas made by the factory outside Paris that provided Monet throughout the painting of the Rouen Cathedral series. Both the fabric and the glue appear very old, though there is no precise dating technique for them. And there was no trace of solvents that might have been used to strip paint off a genuine canvas of the period. I then turned to the paint. "Follow so far?" she asked sharply. "Paint?" "You may proceed without further sarcasm, unless unable to control yourself." The palette of an artist as famous as Monet has been studied in detail, so that we know he preferred cadmium yellow to chromium yellow or Naples yellow, that he tended to use Prussian blue rather than cobalt blue, and so on. She tapped the flecks of blue at the base of the cathedral. "Prussian blue." "You've taken paint off the canvas?" "How else test it?" "But I took very small samples, I assure you. Whatever the truth concerning the work, it remains a masterpiece, and I would not mar it. Besides, most of my tests were on the white paint, of which there is a great quantity, as you can see." "Why the white paint?" I leaned over to stare more closely at the canvas. "Because lead white is one of the best dating tools we have. The manufacturing methods used to make it changed frequently around Monet's time, and each change in method altered the chemical composition of the paint. After 1870, for instance, the cheaper zinc white was used to adulterate lead white, so there should be over 1% zinc in Monet's lead white." "And is that what you found?" "Yes. The atomic absorption spectrum showed..." She dug around in the pile of chart paper on the table. "Well, take my word for it."
"I will."
"Nearly 12%. And the silver content for late 19th century lead white should be around 4 parts per million. The copper content about 60 parts per million. So it is with this paint. There is no insoluble antimony component as there would be if the paint had been manufactured after 1940. The X-ray diffraction pattern..." She unrolled a length of chart paper and showed me where 3 sharp peaks in a row had been penned by the machine. "It's exactly right. And there is the proper balance of polonium-210 and radium-226. That's very important, by the way, because when lead white is manufactured, the radioactive balance of some of its elements is upset, and it takes a good 300 years for them to decay back to equilibrium. And this paint is indeed back to that equilibrium."
"So the paints are Monet's," I concluded. "Doesn't that prove the work authentic?"
"Perhaps," Freya admitted. "But as I was doing all this analysis, it occurred to me that a modern forger has just as much information concerning Monet's palette as I do. With a modern laboratory, it would be possible to use such information as a recipe, so to speak, and then to synthesize paints that would match the recipe exactly. Even the radioactively decayed lead white could be arranged by avoiding the procedures that disrupt the radioactive balance in the first place." "Wouldn't that be terrifically complicated?" Freya stared at me. "Obviously, Nathaniel. We are dealing with a very, very meticulous faker here. But how else could it be done in this day and age? Why else do it at all? The complete faker must take care to anticipate every test available, and then in a modern laboratory create the appropriate results for every one of them. It's admirable."
"Assuming there ever was such a forger," I said dubiously, "it seems to me that what you have actually done here is prove the painting genuine."
"I don't think so." But even with these paints made by recipe, as you call them, the faker would still have to paint the painting. Exactly. Conceive the painting and execute it. It becomes very impressive, I confess. She walked around the table to look at the work from the correct angle. I do believe this is one of the best of the Rouen Cathedral series. Astonishing that a forger would be capable of it. Well, that brings up another matter, I said. Doesn't this work have a 500-year-old pedigree? How could a whole history have been provided for it? Good question. But I believe I have discovered the way. Let's go upstairs. You interrupted my preparations for lunch, and I'm hungry. I followed her to her extensive kitchen and sat in the window nook that overlooked the tiled rooftops of the lower city while she finished chopping up the vegetables for a large salad. "Do you know this painting's history?" Freya asked, looking up from a dissected head of lettuce. I shook my head. Up until now, the thing has not been of overwhelming interest to me. "A confession of faulty aesthetics. The work was photographed at the original exhibit in 1895, Durand-Ruel photo 5828 L8451. All of the information appended to the photo fits our painting. Same name, size, signature location. Then for a century it disappeared. Odd. But it turned out to have been in the estate of an Evans family in Aylesbury, England. When the family had some conservation work done on one corner, it returned to public knowledge and was photographed for a dozen books of the 21st and 22nd centuries. After that it slipped back into obscurity. But it is as well documented as any of the series belonging to private estates." "Exactly my point," I said. "How could such a history be forged?" As Freya mixed the salad, she smiled. "I sat and thought about that for quite some time myself. But consider it freshly, Nathaniel. How do we know what we know of the past?" "Well," I said, somewhat at a loss. "From databanks, I suppose, and books, documents, historians." "From historians," she laughed. She provided us both with bowls and sat across from me. As I filled mine, she said, "So we want to know something of the past. We go to our library and sit at its terminal. We call up general reference works or a bibliographic index, and we choose, if we want, books that we would like to have in our hands. We type in the appropriate code, our printer prints up the appropriate book, and the volume slides out of the computer into our waiting grasp." She paused to fork down several mouthfuls of salad. "So we learn about the past using computer programs, and a clever programmer, you see, can change a program. It would be possible to insert extra pages into these old books on Monet, and thus add the forged painting to the record of the past." I paused, a cherry tomato hovering before my mouth. "But I searched for an original of any of these books containing photos of our painting," Freya said. "I called all over Mercury, and to several incunabulists in libraries on Earth. You wouldn't believe the phone bill I'd run up. But the initial printings of these art volumes were very small, and although first editions probably remain somewhere, they are not to be found. Certainly there are no first editions of these books on Mercury, and none immediately locatable on Earth. It began to seem a very unlikely coincidence, as if these volumes contained pictures of our painting precisely because they existed only in the databanks, and thus could be altered without discovery." She attended to her salad, and we finished eating in silence. All the while my mind was spinning furiously, and when we were done I said, "What about the original exhibit photo?" She nodded, pleased with me. "That, apparently, is genuine. But the Durand-Ruel photos include 4 or 5 of paintings that have never been seen since. In that sense, the Rouen Cathedral series is a good one for a faker. From the first it has never been clear how many cathedrals Monet painted. The usual number given is 32, but there are more in the Durand-Ruel list, and a faker could examine the list and use one of the lost items as a prescription for his fake." Providing a later history with the aid of these obscure art books would result in a fairly complete pedigree. But could such an addition to the databanks be made? It would be easiest done on Earth, Freya said. But there is no close security guarding the banks containing old art books. No one expects them to be tampered with. It's astonishing, I said with a wave of my fork. It's Baroque. It's Byzantine in its ingenuity. Yes, she said. Beautiful, in a way. However, I pointed out to her, you have no proof, only this perhaps over-complex theory. You have found no first edition of a book to confirm that the computer-generated volumes add Heidi's painting, and you have found no physical anachronism in the painting itself. Gloomily, she clicked her fork against her empty salad bowl, then rose to refill it. It is a problem, she admitted. Also, I have been working on the assumption that Sandor Musgrave discovered evidence of the forgery, but I can't find it. Never let it be said that Nathaniel Sebastian has not performed a vital role in Freya Grindavik's great feats of detection. I was the first to notice the anachronism of sensibility in Heidi's painting, and now I had a truly inspired idea. He was pointing to the patio, I exclaimed. Musgrave, in his last moment, struggled to point to the patio. I had observed that, Freya said, unimpressed. But Heidi's patio, you know, it is formed out of the blocks of Dover Cliffs, and thus Musgrave indicated England. Is it not possible? The Monet was owned by Englishmen until Heidi purchased it. Perhaps Musgrave meant to convey that the original owners were the forgers. Freya's mouth hung open in surprise, and her left eye was squinted shut. I leapt from the window nook in triumph. I've solved it! I've solved a mystery at last! Freya looked up at me and laughed. Come now, Freya, you must admit I have given you the vital clue. She stood up, suddenly all business. Yes. Yes, indeed you have. Now, out with you, Nathaniel. I have work to do. So did I give you the vital clue? I asked. Musgrave was indicating the English owners? As she ushered me to her door, Freya laughed. As a detective, your intuition is matched only by your confidence. Now leave me to work, and I will be in contact with you soon, I assure you. And with that she urged me into the street, and I was left to consider the case alone. Freya was true to her word, and only 2 days after our crucial luncheon she knocked on the door of my town villa. Come along, she said. I've asked Arnold Oman for an appointment. I want to ask him some questions about the Evans family. The city is passing the Monet Museum, however, and he asked us to meet him out there. I readied myself quickly, and we proceeded to North Station. We arrived just in time to step across the gap between the two platforms, and then we were on the motionless deck of one of the outlying stations that Terminator is always passing. There we rented a car and sped west, paralleling the dozen massive cylindrical rails along which the city slides. Soon we had left Terminator behind, and when we were 70 or 80 kilometres into the night side of Mercury, we turned to the north, to Monet Crater. Terminator's tracks lie very close to the 30th degree of latitude in the northern hemisphere, and Monet Crater is not far from them. We crossed Shakespeare Planitia rapidly, passing between craters named after the great artists, writers and composers of Earth's glorious past, traversing a low pass between Brahms and Verdi, looking down at where Degas had crashed into the Brontes. I think I understand why a modern artist on Mercury might turn to forgery, Freya said. We are dwarfed by the past, as we are by this landscape. But it is still a crime, I insisted. If it were done often, we would not be able to distinguish the authentic from the fake. Freya did not reply. I drove our car up a short rise, and we entered the submercurial garage of the Monet Museum, which is set deep into the southern rim of the immense crater named after the artist. One long wall of the museum is a window facing out over the crater floor, so that the central knot of peaks is visible,
and the curving inner wall of the crater defines the horizon in the murky distance. Shutters slid down to protect these windows from the heat of Mercury's long day, but now they were open, and the black wasteland of the planet formed a strange backdrop to the colourful paintings that filled the long rooms of the museum. There were many Monet originals here, but the canvases of the Rouen Cathedral series were almost all reproductions, set in one long gallery. As Freya and I searched for Arnold, we also viewed them. "You see, they're not just various moments of a single day," Freya said. "Not unless it was a strange day for weather." The three reproductions before us all depicted foggy days. Two bluish and underwater-looking, the third a bright burning off of yellow noontime fog. Obviously these were from a different day than the ones across the room, where a cool, clear morning gave way to a midday that looked as if the sun was just a few feet above the cathedral. The museum had classified the series in colour groups, blue group, white group, yellow group, and so on. To my mind, that system was stupid. It told you nothing you couldn't immediately see. I myself classified them according to weather. There was a clear day that got very hot, a clear winter day, the air chill and pure, a foggy day, and a day when a rainstorm had grown and then broken. When I told Freya of my system, she applauded it. So Heidi's painting goes from the king of the white group to the hottest moment of the hot day. Exactly. It's the most extreme, as far as sunlight blasting the stone into motes of colour. "And thus the forger extends Monet's own thinking, you see," she said, a bit absently. "But I don't see Arnold, and I think we have visited every room." "Could he be late?" "We are already quite late ourselves. I wonder if he has gone back." "It seems unlikely," I said. Purposefully we toured the museum one more time, and I ignored the colour-splashed canvases standing before the dark crater to search closely in all the various turns of the galleries. No Arnold. "Come along," Freya said. "I suspect he stayed in Terminator, and now I want to speak with him more than ever." So we returned to the garage, got back into our car, and drove out onto Mercury's bare-baked surface once again. Half an hour later we had Terminator's tracks in sight. They stretched before us from horizon to horizon, 12 fat silvery cylinders set 5 meters above the ground on narrow pylons. To the east, rolling over the flank of the Wang Wei crater so slowly that we could not perceive its movement without close attention, came the city itself. A giant clear half-egg filled with the colours of rooftops, gardens, and the grey stone of the buildings crowded the terraced dawn wall. "We'll have to go west to the next station," I said. Then I saw something up on the city track nearest us. Spread-eagled over the top of the big cylinder was a human form in a light green day suit. I stopped the car. "Look!" Freya peered out of a window. "We'd better go investigate." We struggled quickly into the car's emergency day suits, clamped on the helmets and slipped through the car's lock onto the ground. A ladder led us up the nearest cylinder pylon and through a tunnel in the cylinder itself. Once on top, we could stand safely on the broad hump of the rail. The figure we had seen was only 10 meters away from us, and we hurried to it. It was Arnold, spread in cruciform fashion over the cylinder's top, secured in place by 3 large suction plates that had been cuffed to his wrists and ankles, and then stuck to the cylinder. Arnold turned from his contemplation of the slowly approaching city and looked at us wide-eyed through his faceplate. Freya reached down and turned on his helmet intercom.
"Am I glad to see you?" Arnold cried, voice harsh. "These plates won't move."
"Tied to the tracks, eh?" Freya said.
"Yes."
"Who put you here?"
"I don't know. I went out to meet you at the Monet Museum, and the last thing I remember, I was in the garage there. When I came to, I was here."
"Does your head hurt?" I inquired.
"Yes. Like I was gassed, though not hit. But the city, it just came over the horizon a short time ago. Perhaps we could dispense with discussion until I'm freed."
"Relax," Freya said, nudging one of the plates with her boot.
"Are you sure you don't know who did this, Arnold?"
Of course. That's what I just said. Please, Freya, can't we talk after I get loose?
In a hurry, Arnold? Freya asked.
But of course.
No need to be too worried, I assured him. If we cannot free you, the cowcatchers will be out to pry you loose. I tried lifting a plate but could not move it. Surely they'll find a way. It is their job, after all.
True,
Arnold said.
Usually true, said Freya. Arnold is probably not aware that the cowcatchers have become rather unreliable recently. Some weeks ago, a murderer tied his victim to a track just as you have been, Arnold, and then somehow disengaged the cowcatcher's senses. The unfortunate victim was shaved into molecules by one of the slaves of the city. He was kept quiet to avoid any attempted repetitions, but since then the cowcatcher's senses have continued to function erratically, and two or three suicides have been entirely too successful.
Perhaps this isn't the best moment to tell us about this, I suggested to Freya. Arnold choked over what I took to be his agreement.
Well, Freya said, I thought I should make the situation clear. Now, listen, Arnold, we need to talk.
Please, Arnold said, free me first, then talk.
No, no,
but Terminator's only a kilometre away.
Your perspective from that angle is deceptive, Freya told him. The city is at least 3 kilometres away.
More like 2, I said, as I could now make out individual rooftops under the dawn wall. In fact, the city glowed like a big glass lamp and illuminated the entire landscape with a faint green radiance.
And at 3.4 kilometres an hour, Freya said, that gives us almost an hour, doesn't it? So listen to me, Arnold. The Monet Cathedral that you sold to Heidi is a fake.
What?
Arnold cried.
It certainly is not, and I insist that this isn't the time.
It is a fake. Now, I want you to tell me the truth, or I will leave you here to test the cowcatchers.
She leaned over to stare down at Arnold face to face.
I know who painted the fake as well.
Helplessly, Arnold stared up at her.
He put you on the track here, didn't he?
Arnold squeezed his eyes shut, nodded slowly.
I think so.
So if you want to be let up, you must swear to me that you will abide by my plan for dealing with this forger. You will follow my instructions. Understand?
I understand.
Do you agree?
I agree, Arnold said, forcing the words out. Now let me up.
All right, Freya straightened. How are we going to do it? I asked. Freya shrugged.
I don't know.
At this, Arnold howled. He shouted recriminations. He began to wax hysterical.
Shut up!
Freya exclaimed.
You're beginning to sound like a man who has made too many bright side crossings. These suction plates are little different from children's darts.
She leaned down, grasped a plate and pulled up with all of her considerable strength. No movement. She said thoughtfully.
Freya, Arnold said.
One moment, she replied, and walked back down the hump of the cylinder to the ladder tunnel, there to disappear down it.
She's left me, Arnold groaned. Left me to be crushed.
I don't think so, I said. No doubt she has gone to the car to retrieve some useful implement. I kicked heartily at the plate holding Arnold's feet to the cylinder, and even managed to slide it a few centimetres down the curve, which had the effect of making Arnold suddenly taller. But other than that, I made no progress. When Freya returned, she carried a bar, bent at one end.
Crowbar, she explained to us.
But where did you get it?
From the car's tool chest, naturally. Here.
She stepped over Arnold.
If we just insinuate this end of it under your cuffs, I believe we'll have enough leverage to do the trick. The cylinder being curved, the plate's grasp should be weakened about here.
She jammed the short end of the bar under the edge of the footplate's cuff and pulled on the upper end of it. Over the intercom, breathless silence. Her fair cheeks reddened, then suddenly Arnold's legs flew up and over his head,
leaving his arms twisted and his neck at an awkward angle. At the same time, Freya staggered off the cylinder, performed a neat somersault and landed on her feet on the ground below us. While she made her way back up to us, I tried to ease the weight on Arnold's neck, but by his squeaks of distress, I judged he was still uncomfortable. Freya rejoined us and quickly wedged her crowbar under Arnold's right wrist cuff and freed it. That left Arnold hanging down the side of the cylinder by his left wrist, but with one hard crank, Freya popped that plate free as well, and Arnold disappeared. By leaning over, we could just see him, collapsed in a heap on the ground. "Are you all right?" Freya asked. He groaned for an answer. I looked up and saw that Terminator was nearly upon us. Almost involuntarily, I proceeded to the ladder tunnel. Freya followed me, and we descended to the ground. "Disturbing not to be able to trust the cowcatchers," I remarked as my heartbeat slowed. "Nathaniel," Freya said, looking exasperated, "I made all that up. You know that." "Ah, yes, of course." As we joined Arnold, he was just struggling to a seated position. "Me ankle," he said. Then the green wash of light from Terminator disappeared, as did the night sky. The city slid over us, and we were encased in a gloom interrupted by an occasional running light. All 12 of the city's big tracks had disappeared, swallowed by the sleeves in the city's broad metallic foundation. Only the open slots that allowed passage over the pylons showed where the sleeves were. For a moment in the darkness, it seemed we stood between two worlds held apart by a field of pylons. Meanwhile, the city slid over us soundlessly, propelled by the expansion of the tracks themselves. You see, the alloy composing the tracks is capable of withstanding the 425 degrees centigrade heat of the mercurial day, but the cylinders do expand just a bit in this heat. Here in the Terminator is the forward edge of the cylinder's expansion, and the smooth-sided sleeves above us at that moment fit so snugly over the cylinders that as the cylinders expand, the city is pushed forwards towards the cooler, thinner railing to the west, and so the city is propelled by the sun, while never being fully exposed to it. The motive force is so strong, in fact, that resistance to it arranged in the sleeves generates the enormous reserves of energy that Terminator sold so successfully to the rest of civilization. Though I had understood this mechanism for decades, I had never before observed it from this angle, and despite the fact that I was somewhat uneasy to be standing under our fair city, I was also fascinated to see its broad, knobby silver underside gliding majestically westward. For a long time, I did nothing but stare at it. "We'd better get to the car," Freya said. "The sun will be up very soon after the city passes, and then we'll be in trouble." Since Arnold was still cuffed to the plates and had at least a sprained ankle, walking with him slung between us was a slow process. While we were at it, the dawn wall passed over us, and suddenly the 12 tracks and the stars between them were visible again. "Now we'd better hurry," said Freya. Above us, the very top of the dawn wall flared a brilliant white. Sunlight was striking that surface, only 200 meters above us. Dawn was not far away. In the glare of reflected light, we could see the heavily tire-printed ground under the cylinders perfectly, and for a while our eyes were nearly overwhelmed. "Look," Freya cried, shielding her eyes with one hand and pointing up the sun-washed slope of the city wall with the other. "It's the inspiration for our Monet, don't you think?" Despite our haste, the great Rouen Cathedral of Mercury pulled away from us. "This won't do," Freya said. "Only a bit more to the car, but we have to hurry. Here, Arnold, let me carry you." And she ran, carrying Arnold piggyback the rest of the way to the car. As we maneuvered him through the lock, a tongue of the sun's corona licked briefly over the horizon, blinding us. I felt scorched. My throat was dry. We were now at the dawn edge of the Terminator zone, and east-facing slopes burned white while west-facing slopes were still a perfect black, creating a chaotic patchwork that was utterly disorienting. We rolled into the car after Arnold and quickly drove west, passing the city, returning to the night zone, and arriving at a station where we could make the transfer into the city again. Freya laughed at my expression as we crossed the gap. "Well, Nathaniel," she said, "home again." The very next day, Freya arranged for those concerned with the case to assemble on Heidi's patio again. Four police officials were there, and one took notes. The painting of the Cathedral of Rouen was back in its place on the villa wall. George Butler and Harvey Washburn stood before it, while Arnold Oman and Heidi paced by the patio's ledge. Lucinda and DeLawrence, the cook, watched from behind the patio bar. Freya called us to order. She was wearing a severe blue dress, and her white blonde hair was drawn into a tight braid that fell down her back. Sternly she said, "I will suggest to you an explanation for the death of Sandor Musgrave. All of you, except for the police and Mr. Sebastian, were to one extent or another suspected of killing him. So I know this will be of great interest to you." Naturally, there was an uneasy stir among those listening. "Several of you had reason to hate Musgrave, or to fear him. The man was a blackmailer by profession, and on Earth he had obtained evidence of illegalities in the merger Heidi and George made 5 years ago. That gave him leverage over both of you. This and motives for the rest of you were well established during the initial investigation, and we need not recapitulate the details. It is also true, however, that subsequent investigations have revealed that all of you had alibis for the moment when Musgrave was struck down. Lucinda and DeLawrence were together in the kitchen until Lucinda left to investigate the shout she heard. This was confirmed by caterers hired for the Solday party. Heidi left the patio shortly before Musgrave was found, but she was consulting with Hugh and the orchestra during the time in question. George Butler went into the house with Arnold Oman, but they were together for most of the time they were inside. Eventually George left to go to the bathroom, but luckily for him the orchestra's first clarinetist was there to confirm his presence. And fortunately for Mr. Oman, I myself could see him from the patio, standing in the hallway until the very moment when Lucinda screamed. So you see," Freya paused, eyed us one by one, ran a finger along the frame of the big painting. "The problem took on a new aspect. It became clear that while many had a motive to kill Musgrave, no one had the opportunity. This caused me to reconsider. How exactly had Musgrave been killed? He was struck on the head by the frame of one of Heidi's hall mirrors. Though several mirrors were broken in the melee following Lucinda's screams, we know the one that Musgrave was struck with. It was at the bend in the hallway leading from the atrium to the patio, and it was only a couple of meters away from a step down in the hallway." Freya took a large house plan from a table and set it before the policeman. Sandor Musgrave, you will recall, was new to Mercury. He had never seen a Solday celebration. When the great gates opened and the reflected light filled this villa, my suggestion is that he was overwhelmed by fright. Lucinda heard him cry for help. Perhaps he thought the house was burning down. He panicked, rushed out of the study, and blindly began to run for the patio. Unable to see the step down or the mirror, he must have pitched forward, and his left temple struck the frame a fatal blow. He crawled a few steps farther, then collapsed and died. Heidi stepped forward.
So Musgrave died by accident?
This is my theory, and it explains how it was that no one had the opportunity to kill him. In fact, no one did kill him. She turned to the police. I trust you will follow up on this suggestion. Yes, said the one taking notes. Death declared accidental by consulting investigator. Proceed from there. He exchanged glances with his colleagues. We are satisfied this explains the facts of the case. Heidi surveyed the silent group.
To tell you the truth, I'm very relieved.
She turned to DeLawrence.
Let's open the bar. It would be morbid to celebrate an accidental death, but here we can say we are celebrating the absence of a murder.
The others gave a small cheer of relief, and we surrounded the bartender. A few days later, Freya asked me to accompany her to North Station. I need your assistance. Very well, I said. Are you leaving Terminator? Seeing someone off. When we entered the station's big waiting room, she inspected the crowd, then cried, Arnold! And crossed the room to meet him. Arnold saw her and grimaced. Oh, Arnold, she said, and leaned over to kiss him on each cheek.
I'm very proud of you.
Arnold shook his head and greeted me mournfully. You're a hard woman, Freya, he told her. Stop behaving so cheerfully. You make me sick. You know perfectly well this is exile of the worst sort.
But Arnold, Freya said, Mercury is not the whole of civilization. In fact, it could be considered culturally dead, an immense museum to the past that has no real life at all.
Which is why you choose to live here, I'm sure, he said bitterly.
And of course it does have some pleasures, but the really vital centres of any civilization are on the frontier, Arnold, and that's where you're going.
Arnold looked completely disgusted.
But Arnold, I said, where are you going?
Pluto, he said curtly.
Pluto, I exclaimed. But whatever for? What will you do there?
He shrugged. Dig ditches, I suppose. Freya laughed.
You certainly will not.
She addressed me.
Arnold has decided very boldly, I might add, to abandon his safe career as a dealer here on Mercury to become a real artist on the frontier.
But why? Freya wagged a finger at Arnold.
You must write us often.
Arnold made a strangled growl.
Damn you, Freya. I refuse. I refuse to go.
You don't have that option, Freya said.
Remember the chalk, Arnold? The chalk was your signature.
Arnold hung his head defeated. The city interfaced with the spaceport station.
It isn't fair, Arnold said. What am I going to do out on those barbaric outworlds?
You're going to live, Freya said sternly. You're going to live and you're going to paint. No more hiding, understand?
I, at any rate, was beginning to. You should be thanking me profusely, Freya went on, but I'll concede you're upset and wait for gratitude by mail.
She put a hand on Arnold's shoulder and pushed him affectionately towards the crossing line. Remember to write.
But, Arnold said, a panicked expression on his face.
But, enough, Freya said. Begone, or else.
Arnold sagged and stepped across the divide between the stations. Soon the city left the spaceport station behind.
Well, Freya said, that's done.
I stared at her.
You just helped a murderer to escape.
She lifted an eyebrow.
Exile is a very severe punishment. In fact, in my cultural tradition, it was the usual punishment for murder committed in anger or self-defense.
I waved a hand dismissively.
This isn't the Iceland of Eric the Red, and it wasn't self-defense. Sandor Musgrave was outright murdered.
Well, she said, I never liked him.
I told you before, she has no sense of right and wrong. It is a serious defect in a detective. I could only wave my arms in incoherent outrage, and my protests have never carried much weight with Freya, who claims not even to believe them. We left the station.
What's that you were saying to Arnold about chalk? I said, curiosity getting the better of me.
That's the clue you provided, Nathaniel, somewhat transformed. As you reminded me, Musgrave was pointing at the patio, and Heidi's patio is made of a block of Dover Cliffs. Dover Cliffs, as you know, are composed of chalk, so I returned to the painting and cut through the back to retrieve samples of the chalk used in the underdrawing, which had been revealed to me by infrared photography.
She turned a corner and led me uptown.
Chalk, you see, has its own history of change. In Monet's time, chalk was made from natural sources, not from synthetics. Sure enough, the chalk I took from the canvas was a natural chalk, but natural chalk, being composed of marine ooze, is littered with the fossil remains of unicellular algae called coccoliths. These coccoliths are different depending on the source of the chalk. Monet used Rouen chalk, appropriately enough, which was filled with the coccoliths Maslovella barnesi and Cricolithus pematoidens. The coccoliths in our painting, however, are neococcoliths dubious. Very dubious indeed. For this is a North American chalk, first mined in Utah in 1924. So, Monet couldn't have used this chalk. And there you had your proof that the painting is a fake. Exactly. I said doubtfully, it seems a subtle clue for the dying Musgrave to conceive of. Perhaps, Freya said cheerfully, perhaps he was only pointing in the direction of the patio by the accident of his final movements. But it was sufficient that the coincidence gave me the idea. The solution of a crime often depends upon imaginary clues. But how did you know Arnold was the forger? I asked. And why, after taking the trouble to concoct all those paints, did he use the wrong chalk? The two matters are related. It could be that Arnold only knew he needed a natural chalk and used the first convenient supply without knowing there was a difference between them. In that case, it was a mistake, his only mistake. But it seems unlike Arnold to me, and I think rather that it was the forger's signature. In effect, the forger said, if you take a slide of the chalk trapped underneath the paint and magnify it 5,000 times with an electron microscope, you will find me. This chalk never used by Monet is my sign. For on some level, every forger hopes to be discovered, if only in the distant future, to receive credit for the work. So I knew we had a forger on Mercury, and I was already suspicious of Arnold since he was the dealer who brought the painting to Mercury, and since he was the only guest at Heidi's party with the opportunity to kill Musgrave. He was missing during the crucial moments. You are a liar. And it seems Arnold was getting desperate. I searched among his recent bills and found one for 3 suction plates, so when we found him on the track, I was quite sure. He stuck himself to the track? Yes. The one on his right wrist was electronically controlled, so after setting the other 2, he tripped the 3rd between his teeth. He hoped that we would discover him there after missing him at the museum, and think there was someone else who wished him harm. And if not, the cowcatchers would pull him free. It was a silly plan, but he was desperate after I set up that appointment with him. When I confronted him with all this after we rescued him from the tracks, he broke down and confessed. Sandor Musgrave had discovered that the Monet was a fake while blackmailing the Evans family in England, and after forcing Heidi to give him a job, he worked on the painting in secret until he found proof. Then he blackmailed Arnold into bankruptcy, and when on Sol Day he pressed Arnold for more money, Arnold lost his composure and took advantage of the confusion caused by the opening of the great gates to smack Musgrave on the head with one of Heidi's mirrors. I wagged a finger under her nose. And you set him free. You have gone too far this time, Freya Grindavik. She shook her head. If you consider Arnold's case a bit longer, you might change your mind. Arnold Oman has been the most important art dealer on Mercury for over 60 years. He sold the Vermeer collection to George Butler and the Goyas to Terminator West Gallery, and the Pissarros to the museum in Homer Crater, and those Chinese landscapes you love so much to the City Park, and the Kandinskys to the Lion of the Greys. Most of the finest paintings on Mercury were brought here by Arnold Oman. So how many of those, do you think, were painted by Arnold himself? I stopped dead in the street, stunned at the very idea. But that only makes it worse, inestimably worse. It means there are fakes all over the planet. Probably so. And no one wants to hear that. But it also means Arnold Oman is a very great artist. And in our age, that is no easy feat. Can you imagine the withering reception his work would have received if he had done original work? It would have ended up like Harvey Washburn and all the rest of them who wander around galleries like dogs. The great art of the past crashes down on our artists like meteors, so that their minds resemble the blasted landscapes we roll over. Now Arnold has escaped that fate, and his work is universally admired, even loved. That Monet, for instance, it isn't just that it passes for one of the cathedral series. It could be argued that it is the best of them.
Now, is this a level of greatness that Arnold could have achieved, would have been allowed to achieve, if he had done original work on this museum planet? Impossible. He was forced to forge old masters to be able to fully express his genius. All this is no excuse for forgery or murder. But Freya wasn't listening. Now that I've exiled him, he may go on forging old paintings, but he may begin painting something new. That possibility surely justifies ameliorating his punishment for killing such a parasite as Musgrave. And there is Mercury's reputation as art museum of the system to consider. I refused to honour her opinions with a reply, and looking round I saw that during our conversation she had led me far up the terraces. "Where are we going?" "To Heidi's," she said. And she had the grace to look a little shamefaced. For a moment, anyway. "I need your help moving something." "Oh, no." "Well," Freya explained, "when I told Heidi some of the facts of the case, she insisted on giving me a token of her gratitude, and she overrode all my refusals, so I was forced to accept." She rang the wall bell. "You're joking," I said. "Not at all. Actually, I think Heidi preferred not to own a painting she knew to be fake, you see. So I did her a favour by taking it off her hands." When DeLawrence let us in, we found he had almost finished securing Rouen Cathedral sun effect in a big plastic box. "We'll finish this," Freya told him. While we completed the boxing, I told Freya what I thought of her conduct. "You've taken liberties with the law. You lied right and left." "Well, boxed," she said. "Let's go before Heidi changes her mind." "And I suppose you're proud of yourself." "Of course. A lot of lab work went into this." We manoeuvred the big box through the gate and into the street and carried it upright between us, like a short, flat coffin. We reached Freya's villa, and immediately she set to work unboxing the painting. When she had freed it, she set it on top of a couch resting against the wall. Shaking with righteous indignation, I cried, "That thing isn't a product of the past. It isn't authentic. It is only a fake. Claude Monet didn't paint it." Freya looked at me with a mild frown, as if confronting a slightly dense and very stubborn child. "So what?" After I had lectured her on her immorality a good deal more, and heard all of her patient agreement, I ran out of steam. "Well," I muttered, "you may have destroyed all my faith in you and damaged Mercury's art heritage forever, but at least I'll get a good story out of it." This was some small comfort. I believe I'll call it The Case of the 33rd Cathedral of Rouen. "What's this?" she exclaimed. "No, of course not." And then she insisted that I keep everything she had told me that day a secret. I couldn't believe it. Bitterly, I said, "You're like those forgers. You want somebody to witness your cleverness, and I'm the one who's stuck with it." She immediately agreed, but went on to list all of the reasons no one else could ever learn of the affair. How so many people would be hurt. "Including her," I added acerbically. How so many valuable collections would be ruined. How her plan to transform Arnold into a respectable, honest Plutonian artist would collapse. And so on and so forth, for nearly an hour. Finally, I gave up and conceded to her wishes, so that the upshot of it was, I promised not to write down a single word concerning this particular adventure of ours, and I promised furthermore to say nothing of the entire affair, and to keep it a complete secret, forever and ever. But I don't suppose it will do any harm to tell you.
There you go. Don't forget, copyright is Kim Stanley Robinson. Stan, sir, thank you very much. And Peter, thank you so much. There you go. That is Starship Sofa's Oro's Ice Show 140. You know what I mean? That they have proved. That is why Starship Sofa is as good as I say it is. Do you know what I mean? You know, that interview with Jack Vance Kin Stanley Robinson story and that fine narration by Peter Seton Clark doesn't get any better. This whole thing is put together by fans. That's, you know, that's the kind of the bottom line here. And I hope you kind of appreciate what we do, you know, support us. And don't forget, we are Starship Sofa's up for a Hugo Award this year. First time ever in the history of the Hugo Awards has a podcast been nominated. You know, that is such a buzz for me. Oh, it certainly is. But, you know, we need to win. So vote for it. If you're going to AussieCon or if you're a supporting member, give us a vote. There you go. That is Oral Delights 140. Do pass the word on. Until next week. Just like to say, good night from me.
Will our heroes survive this terrible ordeal? Can they win through with their integrity unscathed? Can they escape without completely compromising their honor and artistic judgment? Tune in next week for the next exciting installment of
Starship Sofa. Evacuation procedure initiated. Set for launch. Airlock will be opened in 3, 2, 1.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.